The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Ross, Judge Conley, Judge Smith, the Honorable Kevin G. Ross presiding.
Thank you. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Carlson versus Township of Livonia. And good morning, counsel. I will just say for the record what everyone in the proceeding right now is aware of, which is that we are proceeding by interactive a Zoom platform rather than holding the oral argument today live at the Minnesota Judicial Center because of the ongoing emergency due to the pandemic. And I say that so that counsel is aware that you will need to state your name as you commence each leg of your argument. Even though we can see each other now, we are not making a video recording of the proceedings, only an audio recording. So please state your name again with each leg of the argument, with a total of 15 minutes for each side and 5 minutes extra to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that for a rebuttal. Counsel for appellant, you may proceed whenever you are ready.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Stuart Elger. I'm here on behalf of appellants in this matter, Ryan and Tanya Carlson, who are plaintiffs below. The Carlsons brought this action for declaratory judgment seeking declarations regarding their rights pursuant to a recorded plat, the Woods at Lake Fremont, platting certain property for development adjacent to Lake Fremont in Livonia Township, which is in Sherburne County. The Carlsons sought a declaration that under the plat, and their deed conveying them a fee interest in the lot, the Carlsons owned the fee interest in the adjacent property underlying the street designated as 120th Street and dedicated street on the or at the margin of the plat, abutting Lake Fremont on one side and the Carlsons lot and other lots in a development. By virtue of their fee ownership, the Carlsons sought a further declaration that they held riparian rights entitling them to install a dock and wharf out into Lake Fremont across from their property. The Carlsons also sought declarations according to their rights in 120th Street Northwest, that the township's designation, maintenance, and operation of 120th Street Northwest interfered with their rights, with the Carlsons' rights in 120th Street. The township answered and brought a counterclaim seeking a declaration that the Carlsons were prohibited and enjoined from installing the dock in Lake Fremont pursuant to a declaration of covenants that's of record. There were cross motions for summary judgment.
Do I pronounce right? Is it Mr. Elger?
That's correct, Your Honor, Elger.
So Mr. Elger, I want to make sure I understand your argument. So your point is because we should look at the plat and the plat governs, and because it doesn't have the magic language of donated and dedicated, you win. Would that sort of be a fair summary?
Not entirely, Your Honor. It is absolutely our position that the intent of the platters is evidenced in the writing on the plat itself. And that there is no cause to conclude that the plat is ambiguous and resort to parole evidence to, you know,
and
to
ask. What would the, you know, I mean, I've read all the briefs and I've pulled all the cases. I will say I find some of the older cases, and perhaps I'm just misreading them, not as clear in terms of the point you're trying to make, which is, you know, it doesn't have that language, you know, the other side loses. Would the best one I would look for to support your argument be the Etzler-Mondale case, or which would you one would which discusses you know, the donate and deed language? But which, in your opinion, is the case I really should be looking at to say, well, if the plat doesn't have this language, that's the ball game. So what should I be looking at, Mr. Elger? What should we be looking at, Mr. Elger?
Your Honor, I believe the case to begin with really is the Betcher case, which is actually a early 20th century case. And that case, I believe, really sets forth the applicable rule. That court is looking at the language in statute or Minnesota statutes 505.01 that governed in 2003 when the plat was recorded. And in Betcher, the court said, construing this language, that when there's been a dedication to the to a municipality for a street, the owner platter retains the fee, and the municipality receives a terminable easement only. And that rule in Betcher,
I've got Betcher right in front of me. Okay. I don't see. And again, some of these older cases, I find are absolutely difficult to follow the language because it just seems like they're talking in a different. Well, they are talking from a different century. I think I see what you're talking about, but I don't see what I think is the important part of your case is, because it didn't have, but the key is the donate but the donate and dedicated language, where would I be looking out for that language? Because it seems to me that's the key.
Your Honor,
does it not have that?
The language relating to donate and dedicate is not essential to our argument. So what our argument is that under Betcher and its progeny and ultimately the case that you referred to, Etzler, and Bolin v. Glass, all stand for the proposition that if you look at the language, the applicable language in the statute, which dates back to the territorial days, that when there's been a dedication of a street, the owner keeps the fee, the platter keeps the fee, and the municipality or the recipient of the dedication takes a terminal easement only to be held in trust.
So they just screwed up? I mean, is that the bottom line?
I don't think that's necessarily true, Your Honor. I mean, I think that it could, that
being... Well, I mean, everything... I mean, I understand your point is, if the plat says what the plat says, we don't look at parole evidence. But, one problem I have is, not just parole evidence, but the other recorded evidence, the covenant, the developer agreement... it all seemed to suggest that the fact that your client had gotten a heads up from the broker, all the other evidence, parole or not, would seem to suggest it was the opposite. So we just ignore all that as well. I mean, the developer's agreement, the zoning, or the, excuse me, I always forget, it was the city council or whatever, the meetings where they talked about this, the restrictive covenants, all of that is just, because the plat is the plat, and that's all we should be looking at.
Well, fundamentally, that's true. And that's why we have, there are rules in place that require that first, the resort to determining the intent of the party should be in the evidence in the document itself. The words in the document itself. That's a longstanding rule. It's really a rule that arises out of contract, but it's been applied since the early days of the 20th century of this court or of the appellate courts in Minnesota. And the reason, Your Honor, is so that the owners can rely on the plat that they're looking at, that language will be enforced, it's enforceable, and that it'll be construed according to Minnesota law. And on the basis of that, they can make economic decisions about how they're going to use their
property. Just so I clear, if the plat did have the magic language, you would have lost, right?
Well, if for example, yeah, and that happened in this plat, Your Honor, there, not that we lost, but there is specific language where the The developer donated a County Road 38 or 39. I get those mixed up, but anyway, dedicated in fee the county road, and so where the platter specifically intended to do that, that was done, and so I think this plat is.
So they did screw up.
No, I think this is their intent. I mean, the intent of the platter, you know, whether the township thought something otherwise, I suppose, is another question. But the platters, when they wrote the language in this plat, I think knew exactly what they were doing. And so when they intended to donate in fee, they did that. And they knew that a dedication of the streets and so forth would be easement. And actually, there's no reference in a developer's agreement to a termination or extinguishment of riparian rights for owners. There, in fact, if you look at the development agreement, there's reference to.
But I mean, would you agree, Mr. Alger? I mean, you know, there's kind of lakeshore property, and then there's property where you're not on the lake. There's a road or there's something between you and the lake. And it's generally speaking, which is why it's cheaper than lakeshore property. Because, you know, if it's lakeshore property, by God, you know, you're going to have a dock there. If there's a road between you or a road or land or whatever it is between your property and the lake, you know, it's maybe less clear. So what my concern is that your clients are advocating for a position that they certainly didn't pay for, because they didn't have lakeshore property. They had lakeshore, they had property that had a road between, a service road, a road, you know, something between them and the lake. And now, because of how the plat came out, and, you know, they're trying to get something that they really aren't entitled to. Why isn't that relevant? Or maybe you think I'm wrong. I mean, I could be wrong.
Yeah, well, Your Honor, I don't think they're getting something that they're entitled to. They were not entitled to.
They were told you cannot put their broker told them no dock, right?
There was an email. I think what you're referring to in the record was an email to the broker saying that in the opinion of that writer, who I believe was from the township, that the township didn't want docks in the lake. And, you know, we can, you know, that information or that position conveyed to the broker is there and can be constructively applied to the Carlsons. But that is not necessarily what the Carlsons understood and what they bargained for in this case. There's nothing in the record indicating that they paid less or got, you know, a fire sale deal because of the purchase price they paid for this property.
Does it matter as a matter of law whether they get a deal or not?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. It does not matter. Of course, property owners get deals all the time. That doesn't bear on the legal effect of the documents they received. Here they received a deed that made reference to their lot in a block that made in an area that was platted where they're adjacent to a street, and on the other side of the street is a lake. And under longstanding Minnesota law, under those circumstances, they, as the lot owner, they own the fee under the entire width of the street that gets them to the lake. And as a consequence, they have riparian rights that they're able to enjoy. So know that.
Now, done a little bit of land use law myself, generally speaking, at least when you have a residential neighborhood where you have homes on either side of the street, the fee, if there is a fee, extends to the center line of the street. Would that be an appropriate way to interpret this as allowing the fee to go only to the center line and then the government maintaining everything on the opposite side of that street?
No, Your Honor, that would not be appropriate here. You are correct that when When there is a platted street and you have lot owners on either side, that the rule is that that they own the fee to the center of the street. But the rule that was enunciated in Waite v. May back in 1892 and in Ray Robbins in 1885 before that provides that when there aren't lot owners on the other side, where the platter doesn't own the property on the other side, and particularly when there's a water such as Lake Fremont, there are tons of cases where this comes up with the Mississippi River. The dedication does not convey the fee, and the platter retains the entire interest under the road all the way to the other side of the plat. And then by virtue of the subsequent conveyances to the lot owners take that fee interest from the platter. So I think, you know, in looking at this language, the language on the plat, as to the question that you've asked me about, Your Honors, I think that the plat is clear, and the plat should be the basis for the determination here that the Carlsons own the fee all the way to Lake Fremont, and as a consequence of that, have riparian rights.
Thank you, Mr. Alger. Yes. Your time has expired, but you will have an additional 5 minutes of time for rebuttal if you'd like to use it.
Thank you, Your Honor. I will exercise that right. Thank you.
Wonderful. Counsel for respondent.
Your Honor, Ken Bayless on behalf of Livonia Township. Appellants have devoted the entirety of the argument they've just presented on one of the five issues that were presented to the trial court below. And by the time I conclude, I hope I can get to some of those other issues because I do think that they are important to the disposition of this case. And I want to point out initially that the entirety of that argument that was just presented doesn't matter if the restrictions that are placed on the lot are enforceable. So in order to prevail here, what plaintiff has to do or appellant has to do is, first of all, they have to get to the lakeshore, and they have to do that through the process they're talking about by contending they have the underlying fee. And once they get to the lakeshore, then they have to establish they have a right to a dock. And that would be generally true, except that when this particular subdivision was approved, there was not only the plat, there were also the restrictions and covenants that accompanied the plat. So they also
had. If I may, let's focus then on what was conveyed, if anything, to the city.
Yes.
Or to the township. Okay. What, I mean, plats, you know, that you should, like, the idea you should be, a person should be able to rely on these perhaps for decades. I mean, this happens to be 13 years ago, but it could have been 50 years ago, right? So, I mean, we need to be able to look at these legal records and understand what happened.
Right.
Even irrespective of a particular purchaser's expectation decades later, perhaps. So if we look at the actual language in this plat, that did, by the way, have a difference between what happened with County Road 39 and here, but if we even just look at this, where it was dedicated for the purpose to public use for the purpose of a, I don't have it right in front of me, I'm sorry. I'm not really seeing why that does not follow the general rule that the fee title stays with the platter. I don't really get why it's different from others and what's wrong with that language.
Sure, Your Honor. So the trial court was well aware of the general rule. And if you look at page, I think it's 14 of its order, it cited all these cases where the general rule is stated. Yeah. But in both Waite v. Jefferson, which we've cited in our brief, and Waite v. May, the Supreme Court has said that if there are cogent reasons that a different result obtains, then the court is going to adopt those principles. And in this case, what distinguishes it from all of those other cases is we've got a situation where the governmental entity is still in possession of the road. If you look at all those cases, Etzler v. Mondale, they weren't using it as a park anymore. They were using it to store activities. In the Drake case, it used to
right,
be-
Right, but was wait, I mean, the cogent reasons, I mean, is the argument then, if you seem to be going maybe in two directions here that I want to understand. Is your argument that notwithstanding the plain language of the plat, if there are cogent reasons, you can look elsewhere for cogent reasons, notwithstanding the plain language of the plat. I don't know that Waite actually dealt with this statute and this precise issue. So I'm a little bit confused by that.
The statute was similar at the time. It's been around for a long time. But if you look, there's some ambiguity here. The trial court found there was some ambiguity because it didn't understand exactly what was going on. Because when you think
about— Did the trial court need to find that ambiguity in order to look for other cogent reasons?
I don't think so. Because if you look at all these cases, in every single case, the court looks to the surrounding circumstances of the plat approval in every single case. So if you look at the Drake case, they talk about the steamboat landing and they talk about what actually happened. And in this case, one really important fact is this whole question of why exactly is it that the developer's agreement provides that the parcels of land to the west of the road are going to be transferred to the township. Why do we think that is? That was important to the trial court because it establishes that something else was going on here. It wasn't a situation where they simply wanted the landowner to have those rights, not only out to the center line of the road, but all the way across to the other side of the lake.
Right, but that feels to me a lot like just parole evidence, that these are things that go outside of the plat. And I'm lost a bit on your argument. Maybe you can go back to it and clarify it for me, that you see as a cogent reason why the landholder, the lot holder, doesn't retain fee if the road is still being used as a road. How would that bear upon who owns the fee?
The point I'm making, Your Honor, is that all these cases that we're talking about have examined the situation with 20/20 hindsight. So in every single case, like the Drake case, it's been abandoned. In the Etzler case, the park had never been used. So it's always a situation in every one of these cases where that very last sentence of 505.01 is at issue that says it's held in trust, and then we determine what happens if the governmental entity isn't using it for the purpose that it was originally intended. So if you look at those cases, they're used, well, what they say.
Let me pause you for a minute. You're saying that determines who owns the fee or what use can be made of the property. Aren't those two different questions?
I'm saying it helps explain the difference between those cases and those other cases. In each one of those cases, it's already been the case that the township abandoned the property for the purpose for which it was originally intended. This is an exceptional case in that regard. I mean, in a lot of those were railroad cases.
No, just to pause you for a minute. I'm not sure as a matter of logic how you're saying that bears upon the question of fee ownership.
Well, if you look at the last sentence of 505.01, it talks about the limited nature of the holding that the governmental entity has. It talks about that land being held in trust. And that's where we get the line of cases that talks about once you abandon the nature of your interest, like if it's dedicated for a high school and it's no longer a high school, then it goes to something else. This is the only case I'm aware of that we've talked about where we're talking about a road that's currently being used as a road. I think that's one basis for distinguishing, but I want to move
on. I just want to be clear because I'm still lost. You're saying that how the road is being used now bear upon who holds the fee? I mean, it goes to the use of the easement if it's an easement, but how does it tell us who holds the fee?
Because in those cases, there's already been some abandonment by the governmental entity. It's no longer using it for the purpose intended.
Again, going back to some of the obvious cases in the middle of the city where you've got roads between parcels, those roads are owned despite the fact that the city of Minneapolis, for example, maintains the streets and they have all their plumbing, the sewage lines run underneath it and the gas lines and there's all these easements. And yet, in most cases, at least many cases, the ownership of the street, the underlying fee still belongs to the lot holder up to the center line. And that's the question, regardless of whether this in the city of Minneapolis hasn't abandoned the use of those streets. I'm talking about the ownership.
I understand what the court is saying. I've got five different issues to address here.
I think you should jump on the other ones.
Okay. One of the points I want to make here is that we've spent all of our time, all of the appellant's time and half of my time talking about this theoretical question of who owns the underlying fee. And we're contending there's an exception because those cogent reasons are present, as the judge found. But there's also the question, okay, fine. You know, let's say Carlson does own the underlying fee of the entire road. Does that then have any consequences with respect to the question of whether or not he can construct a dock? The normal circumstance would be you can, but when this particular subdivision was approved, the subdivision, right in the declarations, it says there will be no docks. So we had the approval of this subdivision with the restriction, there's not going to be any docks. And there's two different reasons that the township can enforce that criteria. Even if Carlson owns the underlying fee, if there's a restriction in the covenant, you also have to find that that restriction in the covenants and declarations is invalid in order to arrive at the result that there's going to be no dock. So then the question is, okay, what basis does the township have to enforce that restriction? And there are two separate bases. One is the fact that it owns property within the subdivision. So it owns an outlot. It's basically parkland. Well, it's parkland, and it believe it or not, it has a dock on it itself. It's the one area that was exempted from the no dock requirement. And so it has, there's a specific provision in there that allows them to have that dock. And because they own property in the subdivision, they have the right of every other person in the subdivision to contest noncompliance. The Etzler v. Mondale case, for instance, when it talks about the notice requirements you have to give people in the subdivision, they're very stringent, suggests that. So the people that are entitled to enforce those restrictions include the people who own property in that subdivision, and that includes us. So that's reason number one. Reason number two, we are the enforcement authority. We have a subdivision ordinance that says we can enforce those restrictions. So even if Carlson owns the underlying fee under 462.358, we have the ability as the entity that enforces the subdivision requirements to require them to comply with that. And the court at page 30 of its order spent some time talking about the equities of the situation. And I don't know that those should go ignored, because this is a situation where basically 15-
They favor you?
Excuse me?
Because they favor you?
Well, I like it when equities favor me. It's always nice. But this is a situation where there were 15 to 17 years that went by before this was even contested. It's not like some of those cases, like the Harstad case, for instance, where the developer objects immediately and says, wait a minute, I want to contest this. Instead, the developer went to the planning commission meeting. The developer's representative was named Olson, and he's saying, hey, this is what we're doing. We're going to have a subdivision with no docks. So then 17 years later, Carlson comes along and says, no, I'm not going to comply. I want to make a point about what happened at the hearing on the motions that relates to this question of whether or not Mr. Carlson knew. It was represented by counsel that he didn't really know if Mr. Carlson knew. My recollection is, and I believe the transcript has been presented to this court, is that during that hearing that Mr. Carlson said that he did know, and that he didn't care because he was a law student. He had taken real property class in law school and knew that it didn't matter what he was told. So additionally, when he went to the closing, he was presented with the covenants and the declarations that applied. Additionally, he, like any other person who acquires real estate, takes with full knowledge of the recorded real estate record. And in this case, the restrictions on the property were duly filed with the county recorder's office.
Because the time is fleeting here, I just want to follow up the argument that you said. All right, so understanding, if we posit for a moment that the Carlsons own the property and they built a dock, and you said, you know, as a property owner, they're standing for, you know, that the township, and then your second reason is independently. So even if the township weren't a property owner, there was authority to enforce a dock ordinance?
Under 462.358, it's the township that has the authority to enforce the subdivision requirements. And the subdivision requirements.
Okay, so is it different from, we have an ordinance and someone down, 300 yards down outside the subdivision has put a dock out and we're going forward with ever administrative process. I mean, there's not an administrative process here to enforce an ordinance. That's being engaged in.
The legislature gave us in 462.358, and then we adopted an ordinance that has enforcement provisions in it.
Is that what the township did here, is enforce an ordinance?
Yeah, because in connection with this dispute, we included a counterclaim in connection with it to address the question of whether or not a dock could be present on the lake. I do very briefly, I have 1 minute left. I do very briefly want to address those questions about the township should be forced to open the road, pave the road, provide different access to the road, doesn't have authority to put up gates, must plow the road, and can't designate it a minimum maintenance road, which are included in counts 3 and 4 of the complaint. The trial court found that that's something within the township's discretion, and the trial court was exactly right. Those are township duties to maintain these roads. Additionally, there's a statute.
Can I ask counsel? I think the argument on the other side is that this is a taking, and that's why they're presenting it. But it wasn't clear to me. Was there a change in the? It may not matter, but was there a change in the township's approach and maintenance of this road, or is this something that was long going on?
It initially, as the township accepted the properties back in 2003 and 2005, I think is when that process ended. It was always thought that this was going to be a minimum maintenance road, and they posted the signs, and they have a gate up that they put up seasonally on the property. Have I answered your question, Your Honor?
Yes, I just wondered if that was like their long time practice, or if that's a more recent development.
Yes, it.
Long time practice. Got it. Thank you.
I see I'm out of time, unless the court has any more questions.
I see that you are indeed out of time, and doesn't appear as if either of the other panel members have any additional questions for you. So thank you, counsel for appellant. Any rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. This is Stuart Elger on behalf of appellants.
Thank you.
With respect to the last arguments made by counsel for the township, what is going on here in our view is that the township is seeking essentially to enforce a private covenant and proceeding under Minnesota Statutes 463.358 to do that. And under the Odell case and the other cases we've cited, a municipal authority is not authorized to enforce those sorts of private covenants. And that's what the city the township is doing here. They make reference to subdivision regulations. The record shows that the subdivision regulations refer to weren't in effect in 2003 when this plat was made and when the Declaration of Covenants was made and recorded. And again, there's nothing in the development agreement.
Why would that matter why does the point of 2003 matter if there are regulations that the township does it matter if they were authorized to make regulations later? I'm not trying to understand why that matters, timing.
The point the township was raising or trying to make was that they had pressed for the covenant pursuant to the subdivision regulations that they pointed to in this case, and there simply were no subdivision regulations in place. The subdivision regulation.
What do you mean? Sorry. I'm just curious what you mean by there were no subdivision regulations in place.
That's correct. In 2003, the township did not have subdivision regulations. Those were promulgated in 2005.
And going to Judge Smith's question, that matters why?
Simply because it goes to the argument that the township was making in their papers that because of the presence of subdivision regulations at the time the plat was made and the declaration was entered into, They had the authority to enforce the terms of a 2003 covenant. It mattered simply because those subdivision ordinances weren't in place at that time. So if the question is, did the township, was the township seeking to by covenant impose an ordinance through subdivisions, at the time the covenant was drafted, there were no subdivision ordinances.
Help me to understand why, as a matter of law, the distinction between 2003 and 2005 matter. I know you're characterizing them as covenants versus subdivision regulations, but what is the law that supports your position that these are unenforceable unless they were in place in 2003?
Our main argument that they're unenforceable, Your Honor, is that this is a private covenant and the township doesn't have authority, notwithstanding when the subdivision regulations were promulgated. The point about that was simply that if this township is arguing that they had subdivision ordinances in place at the time the declaration was recorded, that argument fails because there were no subdivision ordinances in place at that time.
So the statutory basis that Mr. Bayless points to as support for the governmental authority to enforce the subdivision regulations are inoperable because?
Because of the case law, Your Honor, that it's improper for a township or any municipality to enforce a private covenant. That is the role of the private parties to the covenant, not the township. That it's improper for them to essentially, by enforcing covenants, not go through the proper process to by ordinance eliminate the use that the township wants to eliminate. If they want to proceed by ordinance and eliminate riparian rights in Lake Fremont, they can go through that process in an orderly fashion. And if they take rights, then it also should follow that they would pay just compensation for the taking of those rights.
Could I ask one more question? I know we're out of time.
Yes, please do.
Thanks. So just to close this part out. So the township is arguing there's not an ordinance that says no docks. That's not what we're talking about. We're not talking about enforcement of a no dock ordinance. And what they are arguing is they have authority to enforce a covenant, either as a property owner or because of a 2005 ordinance that gives them some authority, then looking backwards, I guess, to enforce the earlier covenant. Is that right? In both cases, it comes down to the covenant.
It is a, the covenant is clearly an issue. And our position is the township does not have authority. They have not presented a justiciable controversy in that case under the Declaratory Judgments Act. And as to the first issue about their status as an owner, they are not part of the general development plan. Their property, Outlot A, is specifically excluded from the operation of the covenants. And so our position is that because of that, they aren't part of a general plan of development that gives them authority to enforce a covenant.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And thank you I couldn't find my mute button there for a minute. Thank you both for your arguments and for your thorough briefing on this matter. And for your oral presentation today. The matter is submitted and under advisement, we'll issue our opinion within the statutory period.